Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Hannah Witten, who is a YouTuber, podcaster, and author. Hannah joined YouTube in 2009 and has a depth of experience of working with MCNs, management, and brands. Hannah is incredibly open about her career and monetization and has created a new event called Creator Table Talks, where influencers can candidly discuss the business side of the influencer industry.
I'm Hannah Witten. I'm a YouTuber, sex educator, author, podcaster, influencer.
Multi-hyphenate.
Yeah.
And how did you like start out? Can we take it back to your kind of education? And you joined YouTube in 2009. Was that the first platform you joined?
Yeah. So 2009 was when I created my YouTube account. But I didn't start really getting into the YouTube world and posting my own videos until 2 years later. Yeah. And it basically was just I don't even know, somehow started watching YouTube videos, got really into watching a bunch of vloggers and was a big fan. And
who were the kind of people you were watching back then?
Like Charlie McDonnell, Vlogbrothers, that kind of crowd, like the Nerdfighteria world was my introduction.
Yeah.
And I saw that all of these cool people were all friends with each other. And I was like, I want to be friends with them. I want to join this community. This looks great. And it seemed that the way to make friends with them was to also make videos, because they were friends with people who made videos. So I was like, I'll make videos. This is a genius idea. And then we'll all be best friends.
That's really nice. So what were you doing at the time? Are you at school?
I was on my gap year. So I was working as an au pair in France. And I lived just outside of Paris. And basically, I would put the kids to bed at like 9 o'clock. And then I was too far out of Paris to then like venture in or like do anything in the evenings. And so I basically spent all of my hours between when the kids went to bed and when I went to bed watching YouTube. So it was like that was the time.
So were the first videos that you filmed from when you were being an au pair as well? So you were watching, but were you also creating?
Yeah, I went home over Easter for a couple of weeks when the family that I was living with went on holiday, and I went home and I filmed a bunch of videos when I was at home. And then when I was like back in Paris, I was doing my little edits and uploading them and stuff. Yeah.
So you'd sort of stockpiled a few. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you recommend stockpiling as a way to, if someone was thinking about starting now?
Oh, yeah. And even if you're like a professional, like I basically had already created the whole like idea about pre-filming and like bulk filming videos and then getting through them. I also filmed at least one video that I remember, but maybe there were more videos that never saw the light of day, because I'd never vlogged before. I didn't have a smartphone. Instagram stories and Snapchat didn't exist, so there was no way for me to practice talking to a camera.
Yeah.
And so I walked around Paris and like did some filming, and I was just like, this is where I go to French school, and like this is the train that I get, like literally that. And I've no idea where that footage is. It's like long gone.
Walking down the street now though and seeing people talk to camera isn't as, you know, strange as it.
No, you see it a lot now. I still can't do it though. I really struggle.
Really? Oh, yeah. I love Instagram soaring down the street.
I can't. I just...
Vertically though, because vertically I feel like you could pretend that you're on FaceTime.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
There you go. Mm. I can't. Yeah. I really struggle. Unless I'm with people. If I'm on my own, then it's really difficult for me to like vlog in public. But
do you prefer doing a sit down video to a vlog?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At home, nice and cozy, can do as many retakes as I like.
What are your favorite videos to create?
I think at the moment, one of my favorite videos to make is this series that I do called Pleasure Trove, which I think of as like a sexy favorites video. One of the things that I really like to do online is just spread joy, I guess, and also just like get more eyeballs on things that I think are really cool and really meaningful. So Pleasure Trove is a way to discuss news topics that are relevant around topics around sex, but then also like share Instagram accounts, events, interesting people who are doing really great things.
What has been your most sort of successful video? I know you did a kind of couple of videos on the porn ban.
Yeah, actually. I like that. That video was great, actually.
Did that ever come in?
No, they scrapped it.
Do you think you had something to do with that?
I don't know if I had anything to do with it. More the fact that it was a bad law and it was never going to work. But I actually recently saw that some of the tech companies that were building the software to do the age restriction thing are now suing the government.
Oh, wow.
Because obviously they've spent all of this money building this software that they now don't need.
It wasn't the whole thing. It was trying to get people who are underage not to be watching porn, but those people would be able to set up a virtual private network anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like really dodgy data collection on people watching porn online. It's just nope. And it doesn't actually stop young people from watching porn. If anything, it stigmatizes it more, and then the shame spiral continues with absolutely no education around how porn isn't what real sex and real relationships like.
Do you sometimes wish that when you were growing up, a version of you was online so that you could learn the things that you're being able to tell people now?
Yeah. All I had access to was Cosmopolitan magazine, like the physical magazine. And I was, you know, a teenager reading this thing that it was written in a way that it sounds like it's aimed at women in their 20s and 30s. But I imagine the people who made Cosmo knew that 15-year-olds were reading it. But all it was just like, how to blow his mind. Like that, at age 17, I was just like, I know 101 ways to give a blowjob. Like, how is that useful?
Yeah, I definitely had a subscription to Cosmo as well. Yeah. We were like 14, just like reading things out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we've gone off on a bit of a tangent here.
Yeah, favourite tangent.
Taking it back, mm-hmm. So you started your channel. When was the first time you were approached for, and you started it because you wanted to make friends with the people that were online.
Yep.
When was the first time that you realised that it could offer some sort of monetary gains as well? When was the first time you were approached by a brand, or was it predominantly PR in the beginning?
It's difficult to pinpoint, but I think it was when I was either in my first or second year of uni. In my first year of uni, I started, like, I was very involved in the community, and because I was back in the UK, I was connecting with a lot of creators who were in the UK, and so it kind of came in the, it was lots of event invites and like going to social occasions. And then I think it was maybe 2 years in that I got a brand deal from Audible.
Oh, really?
And that was through the, what are they called? Oh my God, MCNs. Wow, that shows how dead they are. Because I had signed with an MCN.
Which one were you? Was that Style Hall? Or?
No, it was one in the US called Big Frame.
Okay.
Who don't exist anymore, I don't think. I think they're one of those MCNs that has since been like eaten up by another big US company. You know, the same way that like Disney bought Maker?
Yeah.
I think
that was like £1 billion deal.
Yeah, who bought Big Frame? I want to say something like Nickelodeon, maybe. Yeah. Like one of those.
So how did the MCN work back then? Did you know what sort of margin that they were taking on the
No,
deal?
I really knew nothing. Like I was barely making any money from it at the time anyway. I think I was hitting the threshold every month to be able to get paid, which I think at the time might still be the case, was £60. And can't remember what kind of cut that they took, maybe like 10 or 20%. And I'm pretty sure the Audible thing was the only brand deal I ever did with them. But one of the appeals of them was they had this network, which they called Wonderly, which are all of these like female creators. And that was quite nice to be a part of that. We had a private Facebook group and we all chatted with each other. but I think my contract with them was like a year or something. And afterwards, I was just like, I knew a bit more about the industry. I was doing things by myself, but also I wasn't really in a position where I wanted to be doing brand deals. I was still at uni. I was like, I don't need this right now. So am I doing it?
Did they sort of work a bit like management as well, or was it purely just the some deals could come through? And
yeah, it was purely deals. They kind of, you did have a point of contact at them, and like when you were at that size, you don't get a partner manager at YouTube, so it's quite nice to have someone at an MCN who can then bridge that gap for you because they have contacts at YouTube. But I was at uni and I was just like, this is a part-time hobby for me, so why am I giving these guys 20% when I'm not even looking at it like that kind of thing now?
Had you started being approached direct at that point?
Oh, I don't think so, because I do remember the reason why I stopped going with them was just because I was like, this isn't a priority right now. In my head, I was like, when I graduate, I will then shop around and like have a think about it. But I was just like, no. But
when did you realize that you might be able to go full time and have this as a career?
I think maybe in my like third year of uni.
Yeah.
Because basically, as soon as I graduated, I was like, I'm moving to London and I'm going to try and make this happen. So it must have been at some point before that I realized it was possible. If I was like, this is my plan.
Yeah. And when you did move to London, what was that kind of first year like trying to make it work? Were there any brand deals that you took on that you wouldn't take on now? Because I think there's that difficult point, isn't it? Where you're actually, you know, got London rent and trying to make it work.
Yeah. So I had a part-time job. I really don't remember that many brand deals I did, but I did a lot of hosting and presenting and like making videos for other companies. So I like, even in my third year at uni, I was doing this like monthly show with this channel called Pop Shack. I don't know what they're called now, but that was like 200 quid a month.
We're seeing more of that now, people wanting like to sort of license that branded content.
Yeah, and then I did some work with Astronauts Wanted. I got a role on one of their shows, but it was like I could film all of my parts where I was and then send them all the footage. And I can't remember how much I got paid for that, but I think I probably did not get paid as much as I should have.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have management at the time, and I think I gave them a number and they were like, yeah, sure. And I was like, no, damn it. But yeah, so I was doing a lot of weird little things like that. There was this charity at the time called The Site, now called The Mix, who I'd done one series for about online dating and a few videos to go on their YouTube channel. And then when I moved to London, they offered me a job. So I was working for them 2 days a week, producing their YouTube content and hosting it and writing it and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was how I earned money at the beginning, was basically other people wanting me to be in content or make content for them. I cannot remember what might have been like my first brand deals, but I basically was doing that job for about 10 months, I think, before everything that I was doing on my channel had kind of taken off to a point where I needed those 2 days to work on it. Because I didn't have enough time.
So when did you get management then?
Oh, I got approached by someone, I think it was maybe whilst I was still in third year or towards the end of it. And he used to manage Dan and Phil, so that seemed like real legit and great. I signed with him at this one management agency.
Is that Channel Flip?
No, so this was before Dan and Phil went to Channel Flip.
Okay.
That's how long ago it was. Mm. So signed with them. And then something happened where I think he left that agency. And then he was just like, I'm figuring things out, or I'm starting somewhere new, but I need to basically, I'll let you know. I don't know. It was very like, okay, bye, but maybe see you soon. So I was just like, okay, no worries. Like, I wasn't doing anything anyway. And then I don't know how long later, maybe a few months later, he's like, hey, I'm at this new agency called AAA. Would love to take you on again. And I was like, great. Yes, I'm ready. Maybe I'd At this point, I think I moved to London. So I was like in London at this point, and I was like, fantastic. And then was working with him for a bit. I don't really remember anything about that relationship or like what he might have gotten me. But then he left. He just poof, disappeared.
Yeah.
But then what that agency then did was like, we have another manager at this agency who would like to take you on. And that was James, who's now my manager.
Right.
And then he left AAA to create Free Focus. So I've basically stayed with him throughout that whole time.
So how many years has that been then?
So with James, I remember I'd made the decision to leave the charity to start doing my own stuff full time. Had left the charity, went to VidCon, came back from VidCon, found out my manager had disappeared, found out that James would now be managing me. I'm like, who's this guy? And that all happened in like 1 month. And that was July 2015. Yeah. So I've been with James like 5 years.
So it's your experience with the manager that disappeared.
I don't know what happened there.
Yeah.
Rough start, but like,
yeah.
Then since then it's been great.
Yeah. What is it about James and Free Focus that you like so much? And what are your views on the management landscape in general? Because we've seen quite a few people that are in housing. And
I don't know how I got so lucky, to be honest, because I've been represented by him for almost 5 years now. There's like a really solid foundation there.
And what is it that what are the type of things that you want from management? Is
it someone who listens to you, who doesn't just say, oh, do this deal because it will make us money, or do this thing because we want to have a sweet relationship with that brand or that organization or whatever it is. But I always feel listened to. I always feel like it's very honest between the two of us about what's going on, what deals are coming in.
Do you get visibility on every deal that comes through? Or will stuff get filtered out? What's the worst thing that's ever come through to you?
So some stuff comes to both of us, some stuff just goes to him and then he'll like let me know about it. I guess the worst things that come through are just ones that clearly aren't made for me. You know, they're just like a copy and paste job. Like they haven't even bothered to look at it. Most of the ones like that, James just ignores. Yeah. Like it's quite nice actually having someone to be that filter, because then my inbox is a bit more manageable.
When a brief does come through, what makes a good brief, and does it outline what deliverables they want?
Yeah.
And what did they tend to look like?
So for me, the ideal brief would have a very short summary about what the campaign is and what the goal of the campaign is. Like actually, what does this brand want to get out of it? Is it a raising awareness campaign? Is it pushing product campaign? Is it getting people to come to an event, clicking a link? Like I need to know what their end goal is.
Do quite a few kind of come in without that? And do you think sometimes they don't even know what they want?
Yeah, you're just a bit like, so what's the call to action? I need to know what my call to action is. And they've not put that anywhere on it. I'm like, so what do you want me to actually say? I want a really clear, like, here are the key messages. Or like, here are the top three key messages that absolutely have to be in the content. And here's like a few extra points to help you understand the campaign more, and you can include if you like, or, you know, use it to like build up what you're going to say. There's a brand that I've worked with many times, like in a kind of like long-term capacity on like various campaigns. And they asked to have a meeting with me and another influencer about working with us and like, and how we want that to happen. And so we were talking to them about their briefing document. And then the next time we worked with them, the briefing document that we got was glorious. It was so good, because I like it when also if there's going to be multiple content deliverables with different dates, I'm like, I need that in the briefing document. I need you to be like, one times Instagram post this day, deadline for the content to be delivered to us on this day, our feedback will be given to you by this day.
Yeah, do they give feedback? Do you think that's something that is improving now with brands?
Yeah, it's definitely improving. I've had situations with brands where they just don't get it, or their feedback actually contradicts the brief that they sent. And I'm like, you need to fix this, not me. Like,
do you think that sometimes that's happening because it's not just direct with the brand, it's the brand and then there are a few agencies involved. And it's...
I've usually found that when it comes to the more tricky situations that I've been in, it's because of stuff to do with the brand. That, at least from my perspective, the agency is always very apologetic because the agency is the one that's... The brand is their client. So most of the brand deals that I do these days, there's like four parties involved. There's me, my manager, the agency, and then the brand. And so James is working for me and the agency is working for the brand. And yeah. James and the agency are talking to each other. That's like where the main like back and forth is happening.
It must be quite frustrating when it comes back and it's a contradiction of what the brief was
originally.
And then what happens in that scenario? Because you've already spent the time creating the content. Do you have to refilm and is there compensation for that?
Yeah. So I've had two occasions recently where this has happened. Occasion one, James basically fought my corner. And then the brand conceded and were like, okay, it's fine. You can post the content that you made according to the brief that we gave you. And I was like, thank you. But that took like, I don't know, a few months. Mm. It was a few months of back and forth from actually creating the content. And then in the second instance, the brand just could not budge. It was just a lot of oversight on their part of not realizing some legal issues in terms of like wording of things. So they were just like, no, absolutely not. But I managed to get extra compensation to, because I had to pay my editor again to do different edits of the video. So I got compensation to be able to pay her extra fees.
Yeah. In those situations, and when you do kind of stick and fight your corner, is there any worry that maybe then you won't be able to work with the brand again? And even though it is their fault, it's maybe shutting a door on future commercial opportunities.
I think, again, it depends what the brand is. I wasn't so worried about that example because actually I'm in a contract with them for more content.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to back down on the first deliverable because then that sets a precedent for the rest of it. And so by actually holding our ground, because I'm going to be working with them in the future, I wanted to make sure that the following briefs, you know, hopefully they'll do their due diligence and it will be a smoother ride going forwards.
And you like having exactly when the content needs to be posted and all of those deliverables. What about creative control? And is that something that you've had to battle with over the years? And are people more open to letting you speak in your own tone of voice now, as opposed to at the beginning? Was it like, repeat this sentence?
To be honest, it's still a bit of a mix nowadays. Occasionally you'll get brands being like, this line has to be in it. And if the line, you know, sometimes I'm like, ugh, that sounds so bad, but I understand why it has to be in it. It might be for legal reasons or something. And so, you know, you do it. But that might just be like one line or one little thing. But for the most part, I get creative control in terms of like, they'll be like, here's the campaign, this is the messaging, what are some of your ideas? And so then I'll come back to them with a bunch of ideas and then they will pick their favorite or offer feedback on those ideas. I did some campaigns with Fabletics recently and I knew that I didn't want to just make fitness content. So I did like monthly themes on my Instagram, which is like exercise and disability, exercise and mental health. And that was entirely my idea. And I was just like, I was like, if we're going to work together, this is the only way that I can see it working and being natural for me and also working with my audience. And they were like, yeah, sounds great.
In terms of the briefs that are coming through, is it predominantly Instagram focused? Do you think that you've seen a shift? And where is your favorite place and do you think most effective place to create branded content?
I think I've seen a huge upspike in Instagram brand deals for myself in the last like 2 years, especially in the last year. In the period just before Christmas, I had to create an entirely new content calendar on like Excel for myself in order to manage all of the different Instagram brand deals I had to make sure that it was all spaced out nicely. It was like everyone was trying to spend their yearly budget, yeah. and also like getting those, you know, Christmas adverts in, and it was just like one after the other, one after the other, and I was just like, what is happening? But also, yes, I want to do all of these. Like they sound great. I like Instagram ones because they are usually, you can have fun with them, and they tend to be like easier to do.
Are they mainly about brand awareness, do you think?
The briefs tend to be shorter because obviously it's for an Instagram post. Most of the deals that I do on Instagram these days are like for one Instagram post that might be a carousel and then like three stories,
yeah,
or something.
Which have the links in them, the stories. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of like the package. However, I do think that YouTube is more effective. But that's why YouTube videos cost more. So not every brand has the budget for a YouTube video. And also not every campaign works as an entire video.
Yep.
I feel like it is easier to do ads on Instagram.
But why do you think that YouTube is more effective?
I just think it's less passive. I think you can scroll past a sponsored Instagram post and just double tap it and just be like, whoop, whatever, because you like the picture, but you're not actually engaging with what's happening. If you've clicked on a YouTube video, immediately that's more engagement than liking something on Instagram. And, you know, it's just a photo. Maybe you do like a big essay post underneath it, which I quite like doing sometimes. But I think there is something more intimate and more immediate, like watching and hearing somebody talk. And then the fact that there's links in the description of a YouTube video. So if someone sees your Instagram post and then it's like link in stories, you're then having to like, you know, go to the stories, whereas like you're already on that page where the YouTube video is and the link's like usually right at the top they ask for.
Do you think we'll see more of a resurgence coming back to YouTube as return on investment becomes ever more important? Do you think we've reached peak Instagram?
No, I don't think we'll ever reach peak Instagram, because I think Facebook are probably like five steps ahead in terms of their strategy to make sure that it doesn't die. We'll find out.
What about TikTok?
Oh, TikTok's fascinating. I've scrolled through the app. I can't post anything on there because I just have no idea. I feel like if you're going to make TikTok videos, then you really need to be immersed in that culture, because it's all about like repurposing jokes and memes and dance routines and music and all of that fun stuff. And yeah, I'm like, oh, I don't have the time to commit. I found this
the growth on there is pretty,
yeah, but a lot of people are saying that it's difficult to then translate that growth into anything substantial other than followers on TikTok.
Yeah, do you think that's probably because it's kind of early doors with it, so yeah. It's like the,
I think it is early doors. I think it will be interesting to see how they don't do a Vine. But I think because it's owned by the Chinese company that, and the equivalent of TikTok in China is like 3 or 5 years ahead of where TikTok is here. So I'm assuming that they've got a business plan for it.
Yeah. In terms of the kind of the platforms and diversifying income and stuff that you personally own, I mean, I know that you mentioned that you do podcasting as well, newsletter. How important and data in general, like owning your platform, is that something that you talk about?
Yes. And that's only been something that I've even thought about or realized is important in like the last year and a half. So I started my newsletter last year. And yeah, the primary reason behind that was like, oh, this is an audience that I own. Like, I literally own it because I have to pay for it. You have to pay for that MailChimp. And yeah, you just don't know what's going to happen with the platforms. The people who were having their heyday in YouTube around like 2013, 2014, you know, people were talking about, you know, their channels are dying or they're not relevant anymore. And yes, that terrifies me. But I consider myself quite lucky in terms of the fact that I've managed to still maintain a steady growth. My growth isn't like anywhere near as what it used to be, but
what are your because you speak about sex relationships, do you get demonetized often? And
yes.
Yeah. And were you hit quite badly with the old apocalypse of whenever that was?
Yeah, I think I was, but also I'm not entirely sure because I've never really paid a huge amount of attention as to how much I'm getting from AdSense every month, because it's not an important part of my business model. Because I get demonetized so often, I can't rely on money from YouTube ads.
Yeah.
So I just like, oh, what a great extra little bonus money, but not, by no means am I like, oh no, I didn't get X amount from YouTube this month. I can't afford to pay my editor, or I can't afford XYZ. Because I know a lot of people who their sole income was from YouTube AdSense, and then they got hit hard by it. But maybe I was hit by it, but I think I was just like, I was already being penalized, and I'd already managed to branch out into other areas of earning revenue, so I just didn't really notice it.
Mm. When you mentioned with your Instagram pre-Christmas and your spreadsheet of planning, how organized are you? And you mentioned your business model there. So I think you've done a pie chart before on on different revenue streams. How does that break up? Kind of what's that mix look like?
So it's majority brand deals, and that's like across all platforms. I think my next biggest chunk was actually AdSense, but just much smaller than the brand deals bit. And then affiliates. This was last year though.
Yeah.
And I only ever do this once a year. And so I think it's changed a lot this year. And then I've been working on increasing my Patreon community. What else? Writing. So like book deals, but that's a bit more sporadic. So like once every 2 years, there'll be like a big lump sum, which is the advance for the book.
Affiliates, brand deals.
Yeah, affiliates, you've got brand deals, speaking, podcasts.
In the same way that people kind of watch a YouTube video and are engaged with it, we see the retention rates on podcasts. The podcast that you listen to, what are you like as a listener? Because it's...
Oh, as a listener, if I choose to listen to an episode, I'm pretty much listening to
exactly.
the entire thing.
And I think that is the majority of people. Mm-hmm. I do think the retention rates are very high.
Yeah.
Talked about the different income streams. You set up an event called Created Table Talks. What was the impetus to start that, and was that from a position of kind of frustration, and what were those frustrations?
Yeah,
and what is it?
So yeah, Created Table Talks is this event for creators to basically actually talk about these kinds of topics with each other in a place where there are no fans. So at some events there might be like business related panels, but you can never really like get into the topics because you're still very like forward facing. Behind closed doors, I found that creators are desperate to be able to connect with other creators and be like, how much did you get paid for this? Or like, what is your strategy for XYZ? And actually get into those details. And that's what I've done whenever I've like hung out with friends. And after Summer in the City last year, I basically hosted a very informal like sitsy debrief at my flat and just invited friends over and was just like, let's just all hang out and like actually help each other and talk business.
Yeah, did you notice a big disparity in some of the fees? And you know, is there some standardization, or is it a complete like...
I heavily rely on James because obviously he's got multiple people that he looks after, so he actually has a really good picture, or a better picture than me, of like what the going rates are. And especially like different brands having different kinds of budgets and things like that. There's huge disparity. I don't think there's any kind of standardization. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be disparity between brands and between types of campaigns. Like I'll get paid more for a product-based campaign than I will a like charity-based campaign.
Yeah.
And
everyone is individual, and that's, you know, it's a human
industry. Yeah, and it depends, like, what are you paying for? Are you paying for that person's audience? Are you paying for their expertise? What actually are you paying for?
Do you think that the way that brands and this industry look at value is changing as well? Because I've heard some interesting things in the last sort of 6 months, which is looking more at expertise as the first one. Are they known in that field? Mm-hmm. Then the platform, how long it's going to take to create the content and that actual work, and then the distribution and how many people it's going to. And so it's like a three-pronged value chain.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a much smarter approach than
just eyeballs,
just like, oh, how many subscribers do they have? Because even that tells you nothing about engagement And the general trend that we can see is that people with smaller followings have a much higher engagement rate than as soon as you get into like the bigger numbers of followers, then your engagement drops. But the actual like hard number of eyeballs on it still might be bigger. So it really depends on like what a brand is after. But the expertise thing, 100%. One of the reasons why at my size, I'm able to get really good deals is because I'm not just doing the deals that everyone is getting. That's just like an ad read in the middle of a video. Like occasionally I'll do those ones. But for the most part, the bigger deals that I get are ones where I'm the only content creator that they're working with on that campaign. Yeah. Or like one of three that they're working with, because they've not gone, oh, we need a influencer who is female and has like a young female audience and they're based in the UK and they've got 100 million subscribers. They're not like, if they're looking for that, I never get picked out. But if they're going, oh, we need someone who can talk about taboo topics, we're doing a campaign around periods, we need someone who is influential in the sex and relationship space in the UK, like then my name is top of that list.
Yeah.
That's always really helped me, like having that niche and that topic.
So you have the Summer in the City debrief at your flat.
Oh, yeah.
And then from that,
that was absolutely chaotic, but brilliant. It was just like loads of people in my flat. And then we were all like chatting and then we like broke out into little groups. And this is how much of a nerd I am. I did feedback forms for my friends.
Nice.
And I was like, would you want something more like formal and structured like this? That was like ticketed. And people were like, yeah, yes, please. I was like, right. I'm going to do this because this is something that I want. And so I was talking to some friends about it, and one of them told me about this, like this structure for an event, which is like you have speakers and then you have roundtable discussions. And I was like, that's perfect. That works great, because then you can have some content creators giving their insight, giving their knowledge, and you can like have these like moments of, you know, a bit of expertise, a bit of like, oh, that's interesting, like learning new things. But then ultimately, the main value then comes from being able to sit in groups
and have those candid kind of discussions.
Yeah.
How can you attend as a creator?
There's an application process, because we want to make sure that the people who attend are the people who will be able to get the most out of it. But it's just a little quick form. And then if we think that you would really value from it, then we send you the link to get tickets.
Is it the beginnings, yeah, Hannah? Or it is of a union?
maybe, who knows? I mean, the ICG, how long did they exist for? They were like the Internet Creators Guild that was like born of Hank Green, but that ended up disbanding after.
I think there are a few players in the market that, yeah, are looking to do that, not from, unfortunately, creator first perspective. A lot of it is on the branded side, but I think both sides of the industry need protecting. But the news lines are often about the brands needing protecting.
Oh yeah, because they're the ones with the money.
But you can see across social media that the huge problems with influencers not being paid, particularly. Have you had a kind of experience of just not being paid either on time or at all? I saw a thread the other day of an influencer that was naming and shaming.
Oh my God,
finally,
love that.
Yeah. Oh. 2 years, one of her invoices was overdue.
Oh my goodness. Mm. Touch wood, I've been very lucky, but I also think that's because James is so good and, you know, hammers them until that invoice gets paid, basically.
Just back to the events quickly. Creator Table Talks. The other events that you go to, VidCon, Social in the City, formerly Summer in the City. What are your views on the events ecosystem that we have? And you obviously have found a gap in the market that you know, Creator Table Talks is something that wasn't there. What other things would you like to see, and how do you think that events in the space could be improved?
Those events now feel too young for me. I really like the industry track at VidCon. I feel like that's more of my level of the things that I want to be discussing. But also the industry track is still, it's not geared at creators, hence why I created one that was geared at creators. But it's geared at agencies and brands. There is occasionally still like useful stuff in there for creators. But the my purpose at those events tends to be like doing the panels, doing the meet and greets for fans. But over the years, just less and less of my viewers are there because the audiences who are going to those events are younger and my audience are growing up with me. And so they're just not there anymore. And me and my friends were like, where are the like big yearly events where the people who have got audiences of adults can hang out? Because I do really value those like events in the year where it's like, oh, I can actually like connect with my audience face to face. But they're not actually, I'm not actually connecting with my audience anymore because they're not there. So I'm like, how do I connect with my audience face to face? I think something that is akin to Stylist Live.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. Well, finally, what are your predictions for, well, actually two things. Oh, what would you hope to see and what do you think that we will see within this space?
What I would hope to see is just more diversification in terms of the way that online content creators are building their businesses, earning revenue. If I'm honest, alternative in terms of less reliant on brands.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to be doing this long term, and we don't even know what that looks like, it's still such a new industry. Like, there aren't that many creators that I can look who are like 5-10 years ahead of me to be like, oh, that's a potential for what my career might be 10 years down the line. That doesn't exist, so I don't know. So what I really hope for the future is lots of people leading the way and being examples of different routes that you can take, that maybe some of those include like not making content anymore and going like down a consulting route or like an events route or some, like all of these things. Like, I want to see creators doing that so that then I can like visualize like, oh, what might I want to do and or be doing in 10 years time? Like, what does making online content as like a 40-year-old look like to me? A lot of campaigns are getting more and more mission focused and like messaging focused in terms of there's like a social purpose to them. So I definitely think that more brands will be doing that, because I think a lot of the campaigns that I think, at least for my audience, work the best.
A big thanks to Hannah for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogosphere.com. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?